Was the Tulsa Police Department affected by the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders? It was in Mays County, 1977. The victims were three Girl Scouts between the ages of 8 and 10. They were raped and murdered, their bodies left in the woods near their tents at summer camp.
One of the girls was the daughter of a Tulsa police officer. Yes, we were affected. I was deputy chief at the time, and there was a major search for Jean Roy Hart, developed by the law enforcement people in the county. We sent a group of officers up there.
There were 70 of us, and I was one of them. Okay. And I was pretty young, and I was very impressionable. And I remember we got on the turnpike, and there must have been 40 Tulsa police cars. We blew through that turnpike gate doing 100 miles an hour. That's a pretty tight little spot there. And then when we got there, it wasn't very well organized. Tulsa police stood out. We had our area. Literally, the thicket was so thick that somebody could be laying 3 feet in front of you, and you could not see them. I remember we all came back covered with stickers and ticks, and it was very hot in the summer. Of course, we weren't successful. And at that time, I had no idea about the hills of eastern Oklahoma, you know, where these Indians reside that were really giving aid to Jean Leroy Hart. Boy, you talk about the no snitch rule. He could be standing behind the door and they wouldn't tell you. So, yeah, we were very affected by it. Walt Milner, I had the honor to work with him for decades. I don't know how he came to work. That little girl of his was the light of his life. And he came to work every day. He didn't complain. He gave the community good service right up until about 2 weeks before he retired with 35 years on. There was a huge shootout in an alley at 2nd and Greenwood with armed robbery suspect where K-9 officer Dick Hobson died and K-9 officer Steve Downey was severely wounded. Two, three heroes ran into that alley, and I have a friend that was sitting a block and a half away, Tim Bracken, yeah, on a perimeter, and he said it was surreal because it was pitch black. And in the alley, this gunfire erupted, and he said it looked like a strobe light, and it was continuing gunfire. He said, I saw three guys run into the gunfire. And he said, I thought it was just going to be a massacre. And he said, I could not believe these three guys doing it. I was at a training with the police academy that night on the Shoot, Don't Shoot program, which we had out at the fairgrounds that night. So I got down to the station and I said, hey, here there's three guys. Who were they? And, oh, well, it was Jim Leach and Tim Pike. And I don't know who the third one was. So I'm in my office area in homicide where everybody collects after a shooting. And over there, sitting in the back of the room with his feet up on a desk, was Walt Milner. And nobody's around him. I went back there. I said, Walt, you okay? He goes, I'm okay. I said, well, I hear that Jack Pike and Jim Leach were involved in this. I said, were you the third guy? He goes, do I have to tell you? I'm retiring in 2 weeks. He was a guy that ran in. They ultimately killed the shooter.
And I heard a different story about Walt Milner, that he walked in there with the 12-gauge shotgun, bang.
Oh, he was pumping that shotgun. And it was crazy. Walt had the shotgun, which those 9 pellets spread out a bit. Dick Hobson's dog was chewing on this guy as he was shooting. Walt said when the guy would fire a shot and light up, he'd see that dog either up high on the guy or down low on the guy. He goes, I had to adjust my aim every time so I'd miss that dog. And he did. Dino was the dog's name. It was just a miracle that somebody else didn't get killed. But here's a guy that's in his mid-50s that's lost the only thing important to him in life, his daughter, to a murder. He's 2 weeks away from retirement. He didn't have to get out of the car. But he ran out of the car, yeah, to do that. Those kind of sacrifices, people just don't know.
No.
You know, they don't understand. You know, that. There you go.
Yeah. Jean Leroy Hart was in that wooded thicket area for quite a while, but then he did stand trial for the crime and he was acquitted. 30 years later, they conducted DNA testing. The results of those proved inconclusive as the samples were too old. There still is conjecture whether or not Jean Leroy Hart actually committed that crime.
Absolutely. But in that particular county, and I think Buddy Fallis was the prosecutor in that case. he's a wonderfully talented man and a wonderful human being, and I think that was the beginning of his end, because he had overwhelming circumstantial evidence on this thing, and the jury of his peers had their mind made up before the first word was spoken in that trial. Yeah, DNA is inconclusive or whatever, but for those years of all of our development time, murder cases were made on circumstantial evidence. I try to tell people, you know, you walk in there and there are no pieces of puzzle put together, but when you walk out, that 500-piece puzzle may have, you know, three-fourths of it together, and you may know, oh, gee, that's a rose garden. Well, that's how circumstantial evidence worked, and you couldn't make it up, or at least an honest officer, prosecutor, whatever, couldn't make it up, and it told such a story. And now it's like, well, where's the DNA? Well, DNA doesn't just, you know, us sitting here, if we don't sneeze, we don't slobber, we don't drink something, we don't leave some bodily fluid behind, it's just not there. I mean, now they have touch DNA, but if you go in and you've got gloves on, you don't touch.
Well, the television program CSI has raised public expectations beyond belief because, first, there's no laboratory in the world that has all of the equipment that they show being used on any minor case even. And second, oftentimes there is simply no physical evidence of any type. I mean, you may have some footprints in a carpet, but they're unidentifiable. You may have some marks on a windowsill, and they're not identifiable ordinarily. Oh, and the results are not instantaneous, as they're shown on television. So it's raised expectations unbelievably, and I think in many cases to the detriment of law enforcement, because people walk in, as Mike said, and expect you to have DNA in every case.
I am sure in the closing arguments of Whitey Bulger, the defense attorneys say there's no DNA. Well, no, there's absolutely no DNA. But to somebody, that's going to resonate.
Yep. And many of the crimes that Whitey was involved in were before 1987, and that's when the first use of DNA in a criminal trial took place.